and welcome back to AASA, the School Superintendent Association's Public Education Policy Podcast, or PEP Talk for short. I am Kat Sturdivant, the AASA Advocacy and Governance Coordinator, and your producer at the top of each episode. This month, I wanted to spotlight something we've been hearing a lot about at AASA, superintendent attrition. Where are superintendents going? Why are they moving districts? Are they retiring? What about women superintendents and superintendents of color? So many questions to answer, so I had the perfect guest to call up. I reached out to Dr. Rachel S. White, Assistant Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, to chat with me all about this. Her research centers around issues of power, voice, diversity, and inclusion in education policymaking and implementation processes, and examining structures and policies that contribute to or counteract equitable and socially just K-12 education. She's also the founder of the Superintendent Lab, a central hub for data, research, insights, and innovation on the school district superintendency, and frequently works with AASA, which I mentioned as we have the upcoming decennial survey next year. So with that, I'm going to say welcome, Rachel.
Thanks, Kat. I'm excited to be here.
So let's do some level setting to get us started. Attrition in the superintendency is something that we're hearing a lot about right now, especially at AASA, as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. And that is what I wanted to talk about on our episode today. So give us some background on what the last few years of data have looked like in terms of superintendent attrition.
Yeah, it's a good question and one that I'm really excited to be able to speak to. We haven't really had a lot of data, especially at a national level. There has been no data to really understand superintendent attrition and the variation that we see. So at the highest level, attrition is increasing by quite a bit over the last 5 years. We saw an increase from attrition rate of 14.2% after the 2019-20 school year. So that was right after the COVID-19 pandemic hit the schools. And then this most recent school year, going into the 2023-24 school year, the attrition rate was 17.3%. And so that to me sort of indicates a lot of things, but it could potentially indicate that superintendents were leading through times of crisis. So the pandemic hit and they felt like, you know, I got to stay, get my district through this. So rates were relatively low in 2019-20. And then we've just been seeing increased rates over the last 4 years. About three quarters of states have more than half of their districts have experienced at least one superintendent departure since 2019-20. And then I think it's just important to note that these attrition rates are not uniform. So those are our national rates, but we see a lot of variation by state, but also by like locale and districts and demographics, right? This past year, superintendent attrition was greater than 20% in 14 states. Some states, attrition was actually close to 30%. In other states, attrition was more like 10%, right? And so there's a lot of variation that we really do need to pay attention to. The other one that I'll talk about is just attrition over the past 4 years has really steadily climbed in rural communities. So in 2019-20, superintendent attrition in rural districts was around 14.5%. And this past year was 18.2%. So it's been increasing quite a bit. And we see a similar trend in cities that increased from about 15% in 2019-20 to over 20% the last 2 years. We don't see as much volatility in districts that are classified as town districts, so slightly larger than rural districts. And then in suburban districts, it's a little bit of an anomaly in that we saw a big jump in attrition after the 2020-2021 school year. So it increased from 13.3% to 18.3% in 1 year, but that has calmed down a bit and settled around 15 to 16% the last couple of years. And some of my research that came out last year did find that suburban superintendents, especially in that 2020-2021 school year, were feeling a lot of political contention, and that was influencing their likelihood of searching for other jobs. So it wasn't just related to COVID, although COVID was definitely a factor in that, but it also was related to 2020-2021, an increasing focus of folks that were pushing back against things like curriculum, pushing for book bans, pushing back against policies that protected LGBTQ students and things like that. So those were really causing some suburban superintendents to look elsewhere. So I'll leave it there. We can break a lot of these attrition rates down by superintendent gender, district demographics, but I know we're going to get to that in a minute. So I'll hold off.
Yeah, I have so many follow-up questions brewing in my head for this. But for now, let me ask, I know another line of your work examines superintendents' engagement in education policy spaces. What intersections do you see between that research and the work you're doing on superintendent attrition and mobility?
My background is I worked as a policy analyst for the Michigan Association of School Administrators, and I worked with a lot of superintendents to engage in state policy environments. When a new bill came down or a new change to the funding formula came down, we were on the front lines of analyzing what that meant for every single school district and communicating with superintendents about, here's, you know, the talking points, and reach out to your legislators and let them know your opinion on the bill. One of the things that my research focuses on is barriers that superintendents face when they're considering engaging in these environments. And I just think attrition is only going to potentially complicate some of those barriers, right? And so if we think about in policy spaces, the importance of trust and relationships between superintendents and either their local board of education or their state representative or the chairman of the state education committee, each time a superintendent moves, they kind of have to start over and make those relationships all over again. If they move to a different community that has a different state legislator, a different state senator or state representative, they're going to have to make new relationships there. And so I just think there's a really tight connection between superintendents being able to engage in this work in a way that's effective and efficient too, right? Like they have lots of other responsibilities. And so having to start over and start from ground zero on those relationships over and over again can take a lot of time. And so I think when we think about superintendent engagement and policy, we have to remember that there is increasing mobility of superintendents, and that we really need to support superintendents when they get to a new community on making those connections, because those are really, really important and are going to shape the educational experiences that they can provide to kids in their communities.
I wholeheartedly agree. One of the things that we usually drive home with a lot of our new superintendents is that they are also in their aspects of work advocates. Like they are advocating for their districts. And we work really closely with a lot of state associations to make sure that they have that welcome, that you know, approach to when they move. So I'm going to shift a little bit. We had talked about contentious districts. So there have been an increased national focus on public schools lately, especially as we enter an election year. So how often are superintendents leaving due to a contentious district? And I guess a follow-up question to that, are they retiring into other professions and going into private sectors, or are they just moving?
Yeah, I love this question, because I think most of the research around superintendent attrition is relatively limited in that we think of attrition as, well, you stayed or left, right? And that's all that matters. And part of it is because that's all the data that we've had. It's a, you know, you either stayed in the district or you left the district or you left the profession. There is some research that's able to look at whether you moved or you exited out of the profession. The issue though is most of the data is at the state level. All of the data was at the state level. And so a superintendent that exited out of that data set, we didn't know a whole lot about what was happening. Maybe they retired. Maybe they moved to another state and they exited out of that state's data system, or maybe they resigned and they moved into a different position, right? And we didn't have a lot of data. So what we do at the superintendent lab that I run with the National Longitudinal Superintendent Database is we collect data on both the nature and the type of attrition. And so I just want to explain a little bit of how we do that, because I think it's important to be really transparent about where the data is derived and its limitations, but also the ways that it does start to at least peel back some of what we know about superintendent attrition, which again has been primarily based on single states or small case studies or state administrative data that really only has variables like superintendent demographics or district composition and salary. And so most of the research focuses on whether or not superintendents move to districts and earn a bigger salary or move to districts with different demographics, right? So at the superintendent lab, when a superintendent turns over, we look up all publicly available news sources that we can find to more deeply understand superintendent attrition. So did the superintendent retire or resign? Did they get fired or non-renewed? Unfortunately, we have to code for things like death and arrest or convictions. We also code if we know that the superintendent moved up. So say they moved up to the Department of Education, moved down. So maybe they moved down to an assistant superintendent role or principal or teacher role. And then we code for whether they moved out. So they could move into a position as an education consultant or a leadership coach, or they could move to a private school or become a professor at an institution of higher ed. So we code for all of those things as much as we can. Of course, there's lots of data, right? Like not all of this is going to be reported in publicly available sources, but we're trying to at least, you know, uncover a little bit here. So in addition to that, we do textual and sentiment analyses to code whether the attrition is either what we call ostensibly amicable or whether the attrition takes place in a politicized context or a contentious environment. And so I want to give just like two quick examples for listeners so they can kind of get a sense of like, what does this look like? We're not just sort of like sitting here guessing. I mean, to some extent, like, you know, this has subjectivity to it, but I want to give an example. So we have one source that says, quote, "The time was to take on a bigger challenge. And I also grew up in this county. And so this was an opportunity to come back close to home and make a difference here." So that would be coded as a resignation and as ostensibly amicable. We, you know, would review multiple newspapers and see if there were any sort of things that would have indicated political contention. And if not, we code it as ostensibly amicable. In contrast, any sort of publicly available source that has words in it, like forced out or amidst turmoil, or if there is a separation agreement in place, or that they resign under conditions that can't be discussed. If we find a change.org petition against the superintendent, right, trying to push them out. If there was a vote of no confidence from either, you know, the teachers union or the board, any publicly available sources that indicate any of that would get coded as political or contentious. So there's also a handful of states that I'll just mention that elect their superintendent or that can elect their superintendent. It's a local decision. So any superintendent that runs for re-election and does not win would be coded as non-renewed, and they would be coded as taking place in a political or contentious environment. An example of a source that we coded as politically contentious resignation says, quote, "He said the stress of running the school district through the pandemic caused him to lose 50 pounds and he passed out due to stress. He resigned due to the stress of trying to handle the unprecedented COVID-19 pandemic, compounded by divisive politics on full display at hostile school board meetings being too much." So that is what we would code as political contention. Now, all of them aren't right like that detailed, but that's just an example of some of them. So I just want to reiterate, like, there's lots of limitations to this approach, right? For example, from other research that I do and then partnerships with folks like AASA and the state organizations, and I partner with a lot of women in leadership groups through the state organizations, I am really well aware that women and women of color are much less likely to publicly discuss their reasons for leaving a district, many times for both professional reasons, but also even personal, physical, or emotional safety reasons, right? So what I'm about to share about the contentious parts of turnover likely underreports the extent to which women, and particularly women of color and other leaders of color, are experiencing contentious attrition, which, as you'll see, is doubly concerning because women are significantly more likely to experience it, even with this underreporting. So now that I explained that, let me answer your first question around how often are superintendents leaving due to contentious circumstances, and are they retiring or going to other positions? So we have seen an increasing proportion of contentious departures over the last 5 years. It's increased from about 9% to 14% nationwide. I also want to note that we don't force any of the attrition events into either amicable or contentious turnover. So if we don't have sufficient data, we literally code it as not enough data. So in the most recent year where we had 14% contentious attrition, we also had 16% of attrition that we did not have enough data to code. And so our team will go back and we'll check those when we collect the new round of data next year, because oftentimes reasons for departure may come out a year or even 2 years after the departure actually happens. And we know from prior years that many times when there's this delay in reporting information, it could be because there's some sort of agreement in place where they couldn't talk about it for a certain period of time, or that the attrition was sort of mired in contention. I would anticipate that the proportion of contentious turnover is actually higher than the 14% that we're seeing right now. In terms of resignations and retirements nationally, the proportion of resignations and retirements used to be relatively even. It used to be around 45% each, but there's a gap that's growing there, with a larger proportion of superintendents resigning than retiring. We're also seeing a significant increase in the proportion of folks that are resigning and moving out to another position, and then also the proportion of folks who are resigning and moving down, for example, to a principal or a teacher position. So we're seeing increases in both those areas. I think you asked about gender too. Is that right?
It was going to be a follow-up question, but yes, I'd love to hear about gender.
Okay. Nationally, with regard to gender, when I run the statistical analysis on all superintendents in the nation, I find sort of two major things. In my opinion, they're major. One, men are significantly more likely to resign and women are significantly more likely to retire. So that's one. And the second one is that women superintendents are significantly more likely than men to experience attrition within a politicized context or a contentious environment. So with regard to that first one, where men are more likely to resign and women to retire, we know from other research, for example, there was some new research that just came out of the University of Texas has something called the Texas Education Leadership Lab. And they just did a report on Texas superintendents. And we know from that women reach the superintendency later in life. And so that is what could be driving some of that. Women come to the profession later in life. And so they have one position and then they retire. Whereas men, for lots of reasons, come to the position earlier. And so they might be able to have two or three superintendencies. So that's one thing. I also run these pretty big sort of national models where I'm holding constant a lot of state and district characteristics to see, like, what is the specific impact of gender on contentious attrition. I find that in general, gender is not associated with attrition, any attrition, meaning that women are not more or less likely to turn over than men over the last 4 years. And even when I take into account that women are more likely to be interims, it's still, there's no statistically significant relationship. And this is in line with a lot of prior research that finds that gender is not predictive of attrition. And in some cases in the past, people have chalked that up to being interpreted as attrition being apolitical, right? That it's driven primarily by salary. So with the national data set, this is the first time that we're able to really look at the nature of attrition. And what I find is that being a woman is a significant predictor of contentious or political attrition. We also find that being in a larger district and then a district with larger proportions of students of color and a larger proportion of students living in poverty are all predictive of contentious superintendent attrition as well.
I want to focus in on the districts with larger proportions of students in color and higher proportions of poverty. So according to your data, these districts are more likely to have experienced superintendent attrition, sometimes multiple superintendent attritions. Why are superintendent attritions so high in these districts? And what are the unintended consequences of these departures?
Yeah, so this is a really, really good question, and one that the quantitative data can't necessarily get at, right? I can tell you what the attrition rates are and that they're different, but the quantitative data can't help us really dig into some of these questions. There are a few things, though, that my qualitative research has identified that may contribute to this. And then there's also these sort of larger societal inequities that might contribute to it. So first, my research shows that women are significantly more likely to lead larger urban school districts, as well as districts with larger proportions of students of color, larger proportions of students living in poverty, and larger proportions of students who are identified as English learners.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And so we also know that women are significantly more likely to experience contentious attrition, right? And so that could be, you know, there's sort of these relationships that are happening there. Some other research indicates that when superintendents move, they move to districts with smaller concentrations of students on free and reduced price lunch. And so it may be that superintendents start in districts that have lower or higher proportions of students living in poverty. And then once they get some experience, they move up. And so to me, this indicates like we, including policymakers and state and local government officials, really need to concentrate on ways to keep volatile and or contentious turnover in these districts down. So, well, not all superintendent turnover is bad, right? Especially if there's a transition plan in place, or if the turnover is, you know, necessary because there's some sort of major issue going on in the leadership. Volatile churn or contentious churn can be detrimental to both school systems and communities. And so superintendents really are positioned as the leader of the district to create a vision and advance equity and social justice in their communities. And they can do that by guiding policy and practice to see that vision through. But it takes time for a district leader to really understand the needs and the desires of their community and build relationships. So in these communities where we have more volatile turnover or more contentious turnover, there are going to be unintended consequences. And I kind of think about those in three ways, three different like costs of attrition, particularly in communities that are serving larger proportions of students and living in poverty and larger proportions of students of color. So the first one is attrition is really financially costly, right? So when a superintendent turns over, there are costs to the districts, like a search firm to hire a new superintendent. Sometimes that search firm can be $5,000. Sometimes that search firm can be $50,000, depending on the district, size of the district. And then sometimes there's legal fees and severance packages related to the departure of the prior superintendent. For example, in Orange County, California, they paid their superintendent nearly $500,000 when they departed. And so this is all money, right, that comes directly out of the district's budget. The second cost that I think about is a cultural cost, right? And so attrition can create perceptions of instability. It can potentially lower morale and can disrupt trusting relationships within the school, but also within the community writ large. And so when you have a lot of turnover like this, there can be some sense of, you know, I don't trust the next person coming in, or they're just going to come in for 2 years and then they're going to leave again. And so why am I going to invest in their vision or their goals for the district? And then I also think about superintendents being one of the most visible public figures in a community. When you have a lot of turnover of superintendents, particularly if they are women and leaders of color, it can convey volatility or instability in a central community space, right? Or it could convey that a district is unwelcoming of diverse leaders that bring really valuable and unique insights and perspectives to the work of schools. So there's sort of this cultural cost that can happen. And then all of that together, like research provides lots of evidence that these types of circumstances can result in unfavorable outcomes for students and educators, right? Meaning there are academic costs to superintendent attrition as well. So in districts that have larger proportions of students of color and higher proportions of students living in poverty, which we know have been historically underfunded, and both historical and current policies and practices have underserved, this is exactly where we need strong and stable leadership. And it's just not really bearing out right now.
Absolutely. 100% agree. So I'm going to go back and talk a little bit about gender, since we've been kind of mentioning it back and forth with a lot of these questions. As you mentioned, women are more likely to be taking these interim superintendent positions, and women are also significantly more likely than men to experience attrition within a contentious district. So what is the cause or the reason, and how can we support women superintendents so that they stay? I know that's more of an anecdotal kind of question, like you said, like sure. We talked about before, but you know, what are some insights?
Yeah. It's a great question, and one that I think a lot of people, I'm encouraged by a lot of people recognizing the need to support women in these roles. I think there's some really great work happening. In some of the qualitative research work that I'm doing, I find that women, and particularly women of color, are much more frequently questioned about every single decision that they make. And many times, to sort of counteract this, women are developing protection mechanisms or systems of support that will help them sort of put up this barrier so that they aren't questioned all the time. Or if they are questioned, they can say, well, here's the process that I set in place, and I followed that process, right? Women superintendents don't get to make decisions that feel very subjective. They try to almost make the decision-making process more objective and very uniform and formal. So either through networks of other superintendents, or they are protecting themselves by establishing formal policies and procedures. That's sort of something that women have to often take on because of they're more likely, they know they're more likely to be questioned about every decision they make. And this can get really exhausting, right? Especially when you see neighboring superintendents who are men who don't have to experience extra emotional, mental, psychological, sometimes physical, right? Labor that has to go in to the job because you're questioned at every step. Unfortunately, even in, you know, it's 2024. And as a woman, I would like to think that we no longer live in a place where we have, you know, gender biases and that there's discrimination based on gender, but it still happens. We still are held to a very different standard. We can't be too nice, right? Or else we're not seen as a strong leader. It's very militaristic in how we often talk about leadership in education. And so being kind and empathetic are not words that many people focus on in leadership, but they are words that are really important to a lot of women leaders. And so I think that that part's really challenging. And then if we do come off as strong, right, and make these really decisive decisions, we have a double-edged sword in that we're, you know, people will call us all sorts of names behind our backs. And so it's hard to walk that line of being strong enough, but not too much. So that's really challenging. And I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done, particularly in school boards and communities in treating women better and really examining the biases that we may come with when we are interacting with women leaders. When I think about like how to support women superintendents, like I said, there's a lot of great work being done, particularly around developing systems of support and networks for women to support one another. And when something comes up, you know, it's really important for a woman to be able to go to another woman and say, hey, I experienced this. Have you experienced it before? How did you navigate it? Those things are important. The other thing that I think about a lot, because of where I'm positioned in a college of education as a, you know, faculty in an institution of higher ed, is that we need to be more attuned to and transparent about the challenges that women face in this position. Oftentimes, for example, we provide classes on education policy, right? That focus on how do you enact and shape policy within your district. And the way that is presented, the readings that we do, the situations that we talk about, often comes from a very white male perspective, because for the most part, the people that have been doing this work for the last century are white men. So women and leaders of color coming to this position are relatively new to the position, and we need to be more attuned to the differences in how we approach policy, how we can approach policy in these spaces. And it's not fair and it's not right, but the way that we show up in these spaces as women is different. And so, you know, I know from my experience, as I was a school board member and a school board vice president, and I also, you know, worked as a policy analyst for MASA, where I was constantly interfacing with state legislators. And I know the way that I was perceived every time that I walked into a room where policy was being made was very different than the way that my colleague, that was a man, was perceived, right? And I think it's important to share this example, because I've said this before, and I've had people question me like, well, how do you know that you were treated differently, right, as a woman? And I've walked into spaces and had male policymakers say to me, like, very first thing out of their mouth is, oh, that you're not who I expected. Or very first thing out of their mouth is, oh, wow, like, you sure know your stuff, right? And it's these words never came out of their mouths in the direction of my colleague who is a man, right? And not that this is a universal thing, right? But we do know to some extent that women enter into these spaces and get questioned in different ways. They get more comments about their physical appearance and things like that. So I think in higher ed, we need to be more transparent with aspiring leaders about the true experiences of women in these spaces and really develop systems of support and help them develop those systems of support to ensure that they feel like they have the resources and the networks necessary to engage in these spaces. I just think pretending that these things don't happen is not helping anyone. And I think it's important for not only to help, you know, prepare women and leaders of color for these positions, but also for the men in the room to know that their neighboring superintendent doesn't get to use the same tone of voice that they do. They doesn't get to say the same things that they do. The men in the room and the white men in particular need to recognize that and work with their colleagues in class to really understand, how do we support one another? If you can't broach this issue with your school board, how can I support you? What can I do behind the scenes to help you?
Some of those comments that you've heard are going to haunt me. I'm going to think about this so much. With that, I'm going to shift to something positive. Yay. In this case, in your report, Gender in the American Superintendency, data shows that women are being selected to take over positions held by men at a slightly higher rate than men taking over positions held by women. In what districts, regarding size, location, et cetera, are women superintendents making inroads? And do you expect this trend to continue?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it was something that I was actually pretty surprised by. If we look at the increase over time for based on locale, we actually see that rural districts are experiencing the largest increase in women superintendents. And a fun little story about me. I grew up in a very small rural community. I grew up on a centennial farm, and my dad joined the school board when I was 1 year old, and he is still on the school board.
I love that.
Yeah. Might be one of the longest serving. I don't know. I really do want to know. But it's been a while. But he is still on the school board, and 30 plus years later, he texted me last fall and he said, "Hey, Rach, you can add our district to your list of districts that have a women superintendent now." And they had just narrowed in their top two candidates, and both candidates were women. So that was really exciting. It was like a full circle thing for me. But was even like more exciting for me, and I often get like really emotional about this, he followed that text up after the night that they actually hired the woman superintendent, and said, you know, he was talking with folks afterwards, and he said, "I realize this is a first for me too. This is my first woman superintendent." And for him to like acknowledge the magnitude of that and what that means for young girls in that community to see a leader of a system, you know, look like them is really important. I never saw women in leadership positions in my rural community, right? And so I didn't know that that was a possibility. It's really exciting. And I think it's exciting to see that nationally rural districts are seeing an influx of women superintendents, because unlike, you know, in a city, right, where you maybe have lots more businesses and more opportunities for leadership, you know, that just naturally there's going to be more opportunities potentially for kids, young girls to see women in those positions. In rural communities, there's not as much. And so it's encouraging for me to see that. I just hope too that in many cases, this is rural district's first women superintendent. And so the board and the community does really need to reflect on what are the needs of women superintendents. And if this is our first one, we need to be in conversation with them and ask them what their needs are, and make sure that we're meeting those needs. And also, this is likely their first superintendent position. And so we need to have some patience and focus on supporting those women in those positions, rather than giving them, you know, a year, 2 years, right, to like turn everything around. The school board needs to think about, how do we support and help the superintendent grow, rather than how am I going to hold the superintendent to the fire, right? So that's exciting. And then the other thing I'll just briefly mention is that the smallest and the largest districts in the United States are experiencing the biggest increase in women superintendents. So it's those sort of mid-sized districts that were not seeing as many inroads for women, which is interesting. You know, many of those mid-sized districts tend to be the suburban districts where pay is most lucrative. They have the most resources. And so the smallest district and the largest districts often have the tightest budgets for a variety of reasons. And so that's, you know, something that I think we need to keep an eye on.
Fantastic. I greatly appreciate all the insights you've provided. And I know our listeners really are going to appreciate all this information too. So what I want to do is ask, where can people find your reports? And or if they want to reach out to you, if they have any questions, where can they find you?
The Superintendent Lab has a website. It's just thesuperintendentlab.com. So on the Superintendent Lab, we have a new page that I just launched recently that's some data visualizations where you can look at variation in these things based on what state you're in. We also have a page communicating our work. I try to produce a lot of research, but I always try to transition that into easily digestible infographics. And so there's a piece of that site that communicates this work primarily through infographics, but I do have links to the more academic papers and as well as any of the news media interviews that I've done that sort of can dig into some of these different issues. So there's that. And then I do want to just mention that we try to elevate the work of others that are engaging in this space. So we've highlighted some other research that has focused on inequities and inequalities in the superintendency, and then really tried to elevate the work that graduate students are doing in their dissertations around the superintendency so that you can read on there about some of the cool work that people are doing. And I'm hoping that this only continues to expand. You can read all about the Superintendent Lab and all of these projects on there. And then you can feel free. There is a contact tab on the Superintendent Lab, but I'm at a public university. And so you can feel free to email me. My email address is just, you know, you could look up Rachel White at the University of Tennessee and my email address will pop up right away. And Kat, you should feel free to, in the notes or whatever for the podcast, include any of my contact information for folks to reach out to. I'm always eager to know what's on people's minds. And a lot of my research, I want to be driven from the ground up. I want to know what's happening in the ways that I can use this data to support superintendents and aspiring superintendents. And so if folks have ideas on, you know, a next research study or how to dig in a little bit further to some of the data, I'm always really eager to hear that.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Rachel. That's a wrap on this episode of AASA's Pep Talk podcast. We invite you to share it by using the hashtag Pep Talk on Twitter. You can access past episodes in the Pep Talk library by visiting aasapeptalk.podbean.com. And once again, thank you for joining us.